Welcome to the Predictable Revenue Podcast, where sales leaders teach you what's working for them and how you can build it yourself.
This episode of the Predictable Revenue Podcast is brought to you by SDR Pods. Learn how we can build you a fully equipped sales development team to execute on personalized, multi-channel prospecting and book you more meetings at predictablerevenue.com/SDR-pods. Hi guys, welcome back to the Predictable Revenue Podcast. This week, we're going to be talking about experience asymmetry. So experience asymmetry can be a silent killer on your sales team. If this is something that you're not identifying and you're not actively addressing, you could be missing out on a huge improvement to your conversion rates. I'm your host, Sarah Hicks, and this week on the Predictable Revenue Podcast, I'm going to be chatting to an expert about experience asymmetry. David Premer is founder and chief sales scientist of Cerebral Selling, author, award-winning research scientist, and four-time tech entrepreneur. David Premer, welcome to the Predictable Revenue Podcast.
Wow, thanks. That was an awesome intro, Sarah. Thanks so much for having me. It's great to be here.
Yeah, I'm really excited to talk about this topic. I haven't ever heard of experience asymmetry named as such, so I'm really excited to get into that with you. To start us off, David, when did you first notice in your career experience asymmetry?
Yeah, well, most people, I started my career, at a relatively young age. I was 25 years old. Let's say professional sales career, not selling stuff at the mall per se, but I started as a solution engineer, solutions consultant. So shout out to all the SEs out there, doing custom coding and product demos and so on. And I joined an enterprise software company. So I found myself oftentimes in boardrooms trying to present my solution to, executives and, these very kind of traditional manufacturing, financial services, airlines, banks, those kinds of companies. And, there was one instance where I was giving a day long demo to this company, kind of show up early, kind of set up my laptop and all my stuff. And the boardroom is full. And one of the executives jokingly says to me, but also their colleague, "Hey, David, I bet we got systems in here that are older than you." Right now, look, I thought I was old at the time, obviously not as old as them. And these are folks that had been there for, 30 years, I'm sure. And there was kind of a little bit of a chuckle that spread around the room. And that's when I kind of realized, these people are sitting there thinking, who's this kid? And what are they going to teach? What is he going to teach us about running our business? And they're actually they were right. They did have systems there that were older than I was. So that was the first time I came face to face with experience asymmetry.
Okay, got it. And when, at that moment, did you realize what was actually going on was experience asymmetry? Were you able to sort of conceptualize, okay, this room of people has way more experience than me. I don't have the experience, or I suppose what was your experience in that moment of what was going wrong?
I wish I could say I had that level of emotional awareness at that time, but I didn't. I was like, okay, just head in the game. We stick to the plan and try to muster as much conviction. Now, thankfully, I was always and still am a conviction seller. So, I like to think that people can tell, and this is part of what we'll talk about today, is people can tell if you believe in your solution or not. And I did believe in my solution, but I was very, I would say, unconscious about it. There was nothing specifically that I did to try to combat my youth other than wearing a nice suit and tie and trying to sound professional.
Okay, got it. Awesome. Okay, well, let's talk a little bit about what experience asymmetry is. First of all, you had that experience when you were, of course, in the tech space, talking about a B2B software with these people. Do you think that this experience asymmetry exists in all fields, or do you think it's particularly concentrated in our field or in the B2B software space?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. So, at first, when I found experience asymmetry personally and with my teams at Salesforce, I'm happy to kind of share a little bit of that journey and kind of how I came to come up with that term. But this idea that, when we have a sales interaction with someone who is older than us, more experienced than us, we tend to be a little bit fearful in that interaction. We think in the back of our mind, why should this person care and listen to us? But I also realized that same kind of fear manifests, with new sales reps. Even if you've been in sales for 10 or 20 years, now you're joining a new company, you don't have the pitch down, you don't have the narrative down, it can be a huge problem. But also especially, and this is, I'd say, especially prevalent in the tech world, is that when we're talking to someone as a customer whose job we've never done, right? It's very difficult sometimes to put ourselves in their shoes and conceptualize, okay, what does this person care about? What are they thinking? What are their pains? And speak with any sense of credibility, right? And I'd say that happens especially in technology, because oftentimes we're selling things to people whose job we've never done. Mm-hmm. Of course, it's different. Like if you're at the mall and you're selling, you know, running shoes and you're a runner, there's a little less asymmetry there, right? But certainly in technology, when we have these new innovative solutions, especially as we're selling to like bigger, more complex organizations, oftentimes not only have we not done the job of the people we're calling on, but we don't even use the technology, for example, that we're selling in our own organization. So that's that all leads to this asymmetry, which is really just manifests as fear, right, in the execution of the seller.
Right. Absolutely. There's definitely, yeah, as you mentioned, a whole lot of layers that exist in the software space that don't exist in these other spaces. I hadn't thought of it that way. I do want to hear the story about when you were at Salesforce and how you kind of came up with the term experience asymmetry.
Yeah, well, so here's what happened. So I was running small business sales for the Eastern US at Salesforce. I'm from Toronto, out of Toronto, but I had reps in New York and Atlanta. Amazing, young, enthusiastic sales reps. But keep in mind, the sales reps that are selling to small business at Salesforce, their previous job was being a BDR, right? So this is kind of like their first full cycle closing role. And oftentimes I would defer to my New York City sales reps, because the New York City reps like hustled like no other reps did, just the most amount of activity and calls and emails and so on. But oftentimes I would have a rep that would have lots of calls. I've been looking in Salesforce, I'm looking at the dashboard, lots of calls, lots of activity, lots of flurry, lots of emails, and then no pipeline. So I would sit down, I was like, so Sarah, like, well, you know, so what's going on? Do you not have enough accounts to call on? And you're like, no, I got accounts. And I would say, well, are you not calling at the right time? Or you know, there's not enough white space people to call the narrative. Like, what's the problem? They're like, no, David, I have all those things. So I would have no recourse but to listen to these sales reps' phone calls. And imagine, so now imagine you're me and I'm listening to these calls and I'm kind of closing my eyes. And I don't even care about the words. I'm not even paying attention to whatever the words are. I'm just listening for like the tone. And what I'm hearing in the tone is I would go to the rep and I would say, it sounds like you're bothering the customer. Like that's what it's, that's the tone that's being conveyed. And I had this little epiphany. Like I have three kids, I have two teenage daughters and a younger, I have three daughters, a younger daughter as well. And so I'm in the prime, like hitting up stage. So my kids hit me up for stuff all the time, right? They want to lift somewhere, download an app, you know, snack before bedtime. And when my kids come to me and they're about to hit me up for something that they secretly believe that I'm going to say no to, right? Or they're not sure if I'm going to say yes to, like, I can tell, like I can feel it just by the way they approach me. Mm-hmm. Right. And it always puts me in like a defensive position. It's like the answer is no, whatever it is.
Yeah.
like, what do you think? And I try to coach my daughters. I'm like, come to me with like conviction. Come to me like thinking that, like, of course, dad's going to say yes to this.
Because tell me the benefits.
Yeah. It's
that if you give me a cookie right now, let me tell you what's going to happen for you.
The good thing that's going to happen. My gosh, it's where I'm in, you know, kind of COVID puppy, you know, that whole thing is going on. So this is what I heard with my reps, you know, at Salesforce. I would hear this on the phone. And this is a pervasive issue because we can't often hide our emotion. It's very difficult sometimes to fake the fact that we have conviction in something. If you picked, for example, something that you innately believe in or you're super passionate about, and I said, tell me about that thing, I'll be able to feel it just by the way you describe it, right? And so the younger, newer, less experienced reps sometimes lack that level of knowledge and conviction, and then it manifests in their calls. And so it's actually the asymmetry is that imbalance, but it was kind of a bit of a takeoff on, I'm a big fan of Dan Pink and his book, To Sell as Human, which I know many people are. And he talks about this concept of information asymmetry in his book, where he talks about, you know, it used to be one of the reasons why we don't like talking to salespeople is because when we went to buy that used car, the used car salesperson knew a lot about that used car and we knew nothing. So there was this imbalance, even though today there's more information parity, it's a little bit more level. So that's where like the asymmetry concept came from. And that's from an experiential standpoint, if I have less experience than my customer, it will manifest in my sales execution.
Okay. And do you think that it's purely experiential what like builds confidence or conviction in somebody? Or do you think there's like a generational thing at play here where that's just what, I don't know. Well, I suppose you had the reps in New York who weren't behaving that way. So it can't be purely generational. But I do feel that there are different, obviously, priorities, skill sets, whatever, that come with each generation based on their experiences in their childhoods, workforce, whatever. Do you think that there's something there?
You know, I would say like mostly not, but there are some. So like, you know, whether I'm, you know, 10 year experienced sales rep or a brand new fresh out of school, I'll still manifest some of those same fears if I don't have that, you know, my pitch down or I'm speaking to someone whose job I've never done before. However, there are challenges, for example, like young people, I group young people together, is that, you know, we don't use the phone as much as an older generation might, you know? So we're like, there's a lot more texting and like instant messaging and back and forth and social media. And so picking up the phone is kind of weird, you know, even, you know, the criticism of platforms like Facebook, like, oh, Facebook's for old people, like new kids, we use different stuff. So yes, when it comes to like picking up the phone and phone etiquette, there are some generational issues, but in general, I don't think there's a massive generational influence in this issue.
Okay. Makes sense. So it's mostly down to experience, but as you mentioned, even like a tenured salesperson in a new role would have a little bit of this kind of hesitance, but maybe they'd know how to fake it until they get that confidence. So if that is the truth, why are more and more companies hiring younger and younger salespeople?
Yeah, look, it's a good question. I mean, I think there's just a massive war for talent out there, and the number of organizations that just simply exist, you know, in every category is just skyrocketed, you know, in the last, you know, 10, 15 years. And so we just need more people to sell our stuff, especially as our solutions become a little bit more complex and new and novel and innovative. We need to describe them to people. So we just need more people. But then when it's kind of like supply and demand, okay, well, I can't get the super experienced, expensive sales reps anymore. I got to keep going, you know, downstream. So, you know, the research that I saw that I have in my book from Trish Bertuzzi says that, you know, the average sales rep, which we kind of knew intuitively, the average age and tenure of a sales rep has decreased, you know, in the last 10 years. And so, yeah, it's just, you know, strict supply and demand.
Fair enough. So what are the top challenges that a younger salesperson faces then when selling to these older, more experienced buyers?
Yeah, well, you know, first of all, you know, because we've never done their job before, we don't necessarily understand the pains and the issues and things they experience day to day. So that, like, that's a big thing. Number two, like, we also don't have like the life experience. So we can't say, well, back in my previous, you know, five jobs, like, you know, here's what I've seen. And also, and this is kind of like, you know, I'd say one of like the biggest things is that, especially in technology, and I know you probably have a lot of, you know, listeners that are kind of in the B2B tech space, it's that like, the things that we do, I mean, look, if we were curing cancer or feeding children in third world countries, we would be able to manifest tons of conviction around what it is we do. But for most of us, if I can say, and I'm going to pull a Ricky Bobby and say, with all due respect, we do like normal basic things. Like I train salespeople and, you know, you're a BDR manager growing a business and, you know, we build middleware and security and like no one cares. Like, you know what I'm saying?
Life or death, yeah.
Like people care, but like, we're not splitting the atom. We're not, for most of us. Now, some of us are, and as important as our jobs and roles are, and our services are, like people have other things on their mind. And so one of the challenges is, okay, like when I go to market with whatever it is I'm selling, how do I manifest the passion and conviction around this, like this thing, which to other people is just like seemingly normal and regular, you know? So that's a problem I'd say like all salespeople have. And we're actually in a tougher position, those of us who work at the company, because we're so close to it. We're so used to it. Of course you want this middleware security, blah, blah, blah. Like, and we think that we're very special. We're this delicate snowflake that's unique and, you know, no one cares because our customers spend a fraction of a percent of a time giving a shit about what it is that we do, right? They got their own problems.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Well, we're going to get into how to, you know, what's the word? Summon up that conviction in a little bit. But I want to talk about the flip side. So there are these challenges when it comes to being a young salesperson selling to these experienced buyers. But what about the other side? What are the benefits to having these young people selling to more experienced buyers?
Well, it's kind of funny. So back in that boardroom scene that I painted a picture of when I was a solutions consultant, and the, you know, kind of the fella chimes in, he's like, oh, David, we got systems here that are older than you. So I go through the shtick, the song and dance. At the end, you know, when you know, this kind of issue comes up again, a fellow sitting next to me said, well, you know what, if we had like some old person coming in here talking about the latest technology, I don't think we would believe them. So, you know, the idea is that the young people, we bring, you know, a certain, and I don't know why I'm lumping myself into this category now, like I'm 46 years old, but, you know, so I still feel young. So, you know, we were able, so young people are able to kind of manifest like this passion and conviction and enthusiasm, which is very contagious if that enthusiasm is harnessed in the best possible way, right? And especially when it comes to new technologies, you know, young people are very accustomed to talking about new technologies and we're familiar with, you know, kind of innovation. So, young people are great, especially in the B2B tech world, of being a great ambassador for that message.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, let's talk about some of the strategies that young sellers can employ when they're, you know, faced with trying to convert these more experienced buyers. And you spoke about it in both your book and then in the Harvard Business Review article that you did on this topic. And that's where I've drawn some of these questions from, because I'm really interested about those, the three key steps that you followed. Can you walk me through those?
For sure. Yeah. So the first thing, as I talk about, is they say, know your pain points, know their pain points. And I'll tell you, like, I actually have a client of mine, here's a great story, a client of mine in Vancouver, B2B tech company. And you know what they did, they use this tactic I refer to as assumptive priming, which is when we get into a discovery call with our customers, we want to show them, number one, we want to show them that we know their business and we know the pains that people like them typically have. We also want to get them to open up. Because one of the challenges that young people have is that if the older, more experienced buyer is thinking to themselves, who the hell is this kid or what are they going to teach me? I'm going to be very reluctant to open up about the inner workings of my business and you know, in signs of self-disclosure. So the idea is, if I can know your pain points based on what I know of you, your role, your industry, maybe, for example, the system that you're using today to achieve that task, I can come back with one, two, or three of like the top things that, you know, we hear consistently from our clients around those challenges. So the number one thing is, I say, like, know their pain points. Because if you come in and start rattling off the pains and challenges, the person's going to perk up and say, oh, you know what, like, this person actually knows what the hell I do every day. So study your customers and know what they think about. That's my first point.
Okay, awesome. So first of all, know their pain, which means you've got to be doing your research both on the company, on the industry, on the persona, all of that stuff to prove that you aren't just one of these inexperienced kids. Like, you've got a sense of what's going on. Even if you haven't lived it yourself, you've found a way to kind of gather some of that experience. What's the next step in kind of, yeah?
Well, I realized I didn't finish that story. So my B2B tech client in Vancouver. So what they do, so when they actually hire, you know, young kids, like, basically out of school, you know, I remember training their team and I remember asking a rep, and I said, what was your last sales job? And she said, oh, I worked at Aritzia at the mall. Right. And so they try to bring in these young, enthusiastic kids and talk about something that they have never, like a particular kind of software that they've never dealt with before. And they said they actually focused on this assumptive priming tactic, which is coming into the conversation with pain points, not generic pain points, but pain points that are based on what I know about you so far. And they told me that they were able to get the ramp time. So they were getting 4-month tenured conversion rates out of reps that had been there for 3 weeks, just by focusing on this assumptive priming tactic. So anyways, I want to complete the story. That's the first thing. Yeah. The second thing I talk about is this idea of invoking the credibility of others. So, like, unless you're like Oprah, like, no one cares what you think, right? When you come to me and you say, well, what I've seen and what I've heard, I'm like, who the hell are you? Right? Like, I'm being facetious here, but you know, we aren't sometimes able to manifest that level of personal credibility. So what I challenge people to do is, I say, like, think about, if you're having a conversation with a customer, who has credibility? Like, if you're trying to bring these arguments, who in your world has credibility? Well, your customers have credibility. They're, you know, they've used your solution to get value. The collective experience of your organization, maybe you've been in business for 5 years, 3 years, 10 years, right? Third party resources, studies, articles in Harvard Business, books, these kinds of things, they have credibility. So what you want to do is, you want to shift what I refer to as the I phrasing trap. So the I phrasing trap is when I come in and I say, well, what I've seen, what I think, what I found, like, no one cares what you think. Okay. So you switch it to we phrasing. So what we've seen, what we've found, what our customers have noticed is, what a recent study in Harvard Business showed was that those things have credibility, way more credibility than you. Or even, you know, if you're talking about your founder, well, you know, look, our founder realized 5 years ago there was a huge gap in the market. And so now these are stories where I'm not manifesting any of my own conviction. I am borrowing conviction from things that actually have it and deserve it and invoking it in my speech. And the nice thing is, like, I can do that on day one of my job. I don't have to do that. You know, I could have this stuff written down for me. You know, we can encapsulate the stories. we phrase and you can use it on day one. And so that's the second thing is just remember who has the credibility and invoke their credibility instead of yours.
Very cool. Yeah, absolutely. We've all got experienced people, whether it's on our teams, founders in an industry where we're well known. Absolutely. There's tons of places to draw that credibility if you don't have it yourself. Okay, what's next?
Yeah. And so the last thing, I mean, there's certainly more, but the last thing I talk about is this idea of just presenting arguments with conviction. And this goes back to what we talked about at the beginning, which is like, I can tell, like, if you believe, you know, when I'm, you know, a really good book, it's a quick read called Talk Like TED. And it talks about like the secrets of like the best TED talkers. And they talk about the fact there's a fellow that they reference in the book, Morgan Wright, who was an 18-year veteran of law enforcement, who did this experiment and basically like took people off the street and showed them like interrogation footage of suspected criminals being questioned. And they asked them like, did this person do it? You think they did it? Right. And they were able to find with like startling accuracy, like random people off the street were able to identify when the bad guy or gal like did it. Right. And so people can tell if you don't believe in what you're selling, if you don't have that conviction, people can tell, like the same way I can tell with my kids. And so, but the problem is that the things that we do are normal things that no one cares about. Oh, we're middleware, we're accounting software, like who cares? Right. So what we do is instead of talking about the nuts and bolts and features and benefits, and oftentimes we'd be like, oh, did you know we're a platform? And what we do is we specialize, like no one cares about your stupid platform. So what we talk about is this idea of like leading with what you believe. Like, what is the mission? Like, why do you, back to the Simon Sinek start with why, like, why do you do what you do? Why does your business, you know, in business in the first place? And the nice thing is, and especially for a lot of startups, like your product will change. Your product may not be even fully baked. And that means that your customers may have some challenges with it, right? And you want them to give you like lots of chances and be on this journey with you. And while your product may change over time, one thing that hopefully doesn't change is your mission, like is your why. That will always hopefully stay consistent. And so this idea of leading with what you believe, if you want to manifest authentic conviction, then you need to anchor your feelings on some kind of, you know, like an emotional anchor, if you will, around what it is that you do. So for example, like if you ask me, so David, what do you do at Cerebral Selling? I could say, oh, I wrote a book and I do training and I do all these, like, but I might say, you know what, look, I believe sales is the best profession in the world. And I believe there's a lot of bad salespeople out there who are not bad people. They're not bad people. They're good people. They're just going out there and they're just executing these old school tactics. And I believe if you want to be at the top of the sales game in the modern era, you need to use tactics that are rooted in science and empathy. That's what I believe. And nowhere in that narrative, that's all true. Nowhere in that narrative did I talk about what I do. I didn't talk about any features or benefits or platforms or anything like that. I led with what I believe. And hopefully you can feel like the authenticity in that. And so that's my last piece of advice is like, if you're new to the sales game or new to your company, get accustomed to like your mission. And the beauty of this tactic is that when you lead with that mission, it will naturally invoke these feelings and you will naturally attract customers who align with that vision. Mm-hmm. Irrespective of whatever the features and the platform and whatever it is that is, right? So manifesting those feelings of conviction and getting the customers that align with your with that mission and what it is you can do to help them is super powerful. So that's what I say, like, you know, lead with what you believe.
Cool. Yeah, very cool. And I'm thinking about kind of applying this then to, you know, there's a new sales rep. Okay, they have the mission, they believe in the mission. I think there's still probably going to be the stumbling block, especially when people are brand new to being SDRs in the like, okay, I'm speaking to somebody who's like a president of a enterprise, a Fortune 500 company. What do I do? How do you coach them on, like, they might have the conviction about the mission, but they might still struggle to like convey that very, you know, effectively. What's your coaching on kind of tone of voice or confidence on the phone? Or how do you portray that confidence while you're learning it?
Yeah, you need training wheels. You need like the water wings. It's all very well and good to say, like, just do this. And so one of the easiest kind of, you know, training wheel tactics that I teach as it relates to what it is that you do is describing what you do in a sentence and using the words love and hate to describe what you do. Now, I'll kind of frame it up. And I, ironically, I got a video on my YouTube channel that's filmed in Vancouver just about this as well. But this idea that thinking about, like, what is it that kind of the desired future state that your customers are aspiring to? Like, that's the love part of the statement. And the thing that is blocking them, or the thing that they're kind of like they're stuck on, that's the hate part of the statement. So for example, in my business, I might say something like, hey, you know, it's cerebral selling. Like, what do you do? Well, look, I realize people love to buy stuff, but they hate talking to salespeople, right? Or I can say in my third startup, so my third startup ended up being acquired by Salesforce, and that's how I got to work there. So we were a social performance management solution. I know, like, who cares, right? It was a feedback coaching and recognition platform. And so what we went out to market with was we said, hey, look, you know, people, they especially young people at work, they love feedback, but they hate performance reviews. You know, or, you know, Trunk Club, which is this company in Chicago that was a service for men who love to dress well, but who hate to shop. And in none of these pitches, I'm actually describing what it is that we do, but using this kind of love hate in a sense. First of all, the words love and hate are emotionally charged regardless. But, you know, again, you're not selling the feature, the platform, you're selling like the vision and the mission. So using love hate to describe what you do, like, let's say, you know, hey, look, people love, they love growing their business, but they hate deploying technology, you know, or they love to get keen, like they love to get awesome insights into what's going on in their business, but you know what they hate to do? Build reports. So you can use this love hate as a simple training wheel, you know, water wings, if you will, to get you in that mindset of talking about your mission versus just the features and functions.
Cool. And then is that something that you could actually say, like, on the phone? Of course, that wouldn't be it. You'd have to kind of go beyond. But do you think even like a newer sales rep, when somebody goes like, okay, why are you calling? What do you do? You can actually say like, here's what we're about.
Absolutely.
Love doing this, hate doing this. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. Love, hate, you know, all over the show. I train my clients in that, and they'll tell you. Now, look, it's, you know, you can, it's kind of like, you know how people, when they do objection handling and they say, oh, you know, Sarah, I totally understand how you feel. Other customers felt the same way. What they found was, so they feel felt found. So like, that's also like an example of like another training wheel tactic.
Right.
But like, as you get more advanced, you don't have to use those words. I could say, hey, oh, Sarah, I totally understand where you're coming from. I have lots of clients who, you know, experience the same. What they realized though, after the fact, was that this, so love, hate is kind of like your training wheels. But you can, you know, you can use any other kind of emotionally charged verbiage to describe the same. The key is just like starting with something that's simple.
Yeah, absolutely. Very cool. I'm going to have to try that out with my reps on the next training day. I'm excited. Okay, let's talk about from the sales leadership perspective. So we've talked about some of the skills that these individual SDRs need to have in order to be able to sell to these more experienced buyers. But what about from the sales leadership perspective, identifying and fixing experience asymmetry? What's the first step?
Yeah, the funny thing is, like, you know, I would not have necessarily picked it up had I not been listening to my customers' calls. Even if I was listening to a transcript or reading a transcript of the calls, mm-hmm. I wouldn't necessarily have been able to pick up the tone. So that's the first thing I would say. And actually, probably the most important thing is I want you to listen to your customers' call, to your customer calls, like with your reps, like listen, you know, you got your gong, your choruses, like you can listen to it at 2x speed, whatever you want. But I want you to listen for the tone. Like that's the most important thing as a leader, right? And then also, you know, trying to certify your reps on some of these tactics we spoke about. So if you're using the love hate, or like, what are the pain points? I mean, there's obviously tons of tactics you can use, but actually, you know, in your team meetings, calling your customers to task and say, or your reps to task and say, hey, look, imagine you were on a call with me and I'm the buyer. Like, what would be a great, like, what would be a great opening line, or what would that narrative sound like? And also, one of the things I'm a big advocate for is that when they nail it, when you have a rep who's able to manifest that conviction, or they use some of these tactics, like, listen to those calls and play those calls back for the rest of the team. I want you to hear Sarah on the phone with, you know, with Samantha here. I want you to hear the passion and conviction. I want you to see the impact it had. So as a leader, I wish I could tell you that you could do this by remote control. The first thing I would say is like taking a look at your sales dashboards and seeing like, is there a drop off? Do you see people with like lots of activity and no pipeline, or even a low amount of activity? Maybe they're scared to even pick up the phone, right? And then start listening to their calls and help them along.
Awesome. Perfect. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show and sharing all that about experience asymmetry. It's a really interesting topic because it really exists like throughout our industry. And it's something that maybe a lot of people don't have a name for or can't put their finger on. And so being able to identify that and then have all of these strategies for actually improving on that is really, really great. So thank you so much, David, for sharing all that with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Sarah.
Before I let you go, tell us a little bit about your book, because I want to drop a link for our listeners to be able to go get it.
Yeah. So the book is called Sell the Way You Buy. And you know, you can find it on Amazon or wherever it is you buy books. There's an audio book if you want to listen to 6.5 hours of me reading my book.
Are you reading it yourself?
I did read it myself. Yeah. No, it was that's a whole other story. But no, I had a blast reading my book. So if you want to listen, by all means, go ahead. The book is kind of in two parts. There's this discussion around the state of modern buying and selling, you know, where we talk about how people actually make purchasing decisions, the mechanisms that actually happen in your brain. So it's a very science and empathy based, book and narrative. So half the book is about how people buy, how we buy feelings, like the emotional component to what we do. There's a ton of obviously Salesforce stories and stories from my startup trenches. And then the other half of the book, chapters 5, 6, and 7, is super tactical. So messaging, discovery, objection handling. It's, you know, tons of tactics, which of course you can view on my website and YouTube channel. I give everything away for free. You don't have to register for anything. So it's all there, but it's a great read, whether you're a sales seller, a leader, entrepreneur, just about how to connect with customers on a very human level. It's actually, I'd say, like the biggest piece of feedback that I get from readers, and thankfully people really love the book, is that it feels so natural for them to be executing these tactics, because unfortunately so much of sales is, you know, I call this, so I was in 1984, I was 9 years old. So I grew up with the Karate Kid movie. So my first, people are familiar with the Karate Kid now because, you know, the shows and whatnot, but my first chapter in the book is called The Cobra Kai Paradox, which is this idea that, you know, you have these like jerk kids who are actually not bad kids, as you see as the narrative goes on. And certainly now in the new show, they don't grow up to be bad people, but they're just using these tactics because that's what their sensei taught them. And so we need to be careful who we let become our sensei, because that's how bad habits get passed down. So I kind of talk about the evolution of like, why don't people like talking to salespeople, and how do people actually buy? And then weave in a whole bunch of very, human feeling tactics around messaging, discovery, objection handling.
So moral of the story, if you're a manager, don't be a crease.
That's right. And Mr. Miyagi. That's right.
That's your takeaway. Okay. Very cool. If people want to learn more from you, where can they get in touch with you?
Yeah. So cerebralselling.com, one word, is the name of my website, you know, Twitter handle, YouTube channel. So Cerebral Selling, and you can hit me up on LinkedIn. I'm friendly by all means, you know, say you heard me on the Predictable Revenue podcast, and then of course, the book Sell the Way You Buy.
Perfect. Well, we'll drop that link for you guys. Thank you so much, David, again, for coming on the show. And thank you to all of you guys for listening to another episode of the Predictable Revenue podcast.